Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight on The Big Show, we cover the Sarasota Film Festival with Director of Programming Tom Hall, discuss Tony Gilroy's new film Duplicity with co-star Rick Worthy, and from the new film The Great Buck Howard, starring John Malkovich, Colin Hanks, and Tom Hanks, we welcome writer-director Sean McGinley. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome, everyone, to another great episode of Movie Geeks United. My name is Jamie, and Jerry's here, too. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, what's up?
How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm excited about tonight's show because it's that time of year again. We're really devoted to this film festival, the Sarasota Film Festival, and every year they have just a terrific lineup of films and special events that just make us go gaga, any film fan.
No, and any film fan, but you do it so well, the coverage of this festival, and this festival is really a lot of great films that me personally would never have heard of if it wasn't for you and what this show does. So I think it's a great
festival. Every year they uncover, and this year is no different. This year's, we're going to be talking about this a little bit later, but Hal Ashby, who among us is not a major fan of Hal Ashby's
work? Right.
They've uncovered a previously unseen cut of one of his films called Looking to Get Out from 1982. It's seeing its world premiere at the Sarasota Film Festival.
That's incredible.
That is incredible. And talking about that, we have a series of shows on the film festival. Our next one will, of course, be Wednesday night, and we will talk about that very film with actor John Voight, which that's exciting.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys had a great time.
Yeah, I have a funny story to tell about Voight calling me on my cell phone out of the blue.
Yeah, I know.
Quite breathless. And Mr. Ashby's biographer, Nick Dawson. So we'll cover that on Wednesday night. And, of course, over the next couple of weeks, we'll have filmmakers from that festival joining us and speaking about their exciting projects. So this is going to be a great show.
It will.
How we're starting out here. This is terrific. The 11th annual Sarasota Film Festival launches on March 27th, one of the most popular and renowned film fests in North America. This 10-day event will cover over 160 narrative, documentary, and short films from the U.S. and around the world. And there will also be a plethora of phenomenal special events and retrospectives. Returning to Movie Geeks United to discuss some of these great films and events is our good friend, the director of programming for the Sarasota Film Festival, Mr. Tom Hall. Tom, are you with us?
I am. Hi, guys.
Hey, what's
Tom.
Up?
Thank you so much for rejoining us this year to share all the goings on at this year's festival. As usual, I'm just beside myself. I can't wait for this festival to occur. Give me a little sense, first of all, of after last year's festival ended. What's the kind of path you take up until now? Do you work several festivals, or what do you do during the rest of the year?
Our year really kicks off again after the festival's over. We spend the summer sort of making plans, trying to raise money for the following year, which would be this year. And then in September, things really kick off. We take off to Toronto for the Toronto Film Festival and meet with a lot of colleagues up there. Some of those bigger festivals, Toronto, Sundance, end up being like a convention for the film festival circuit. And we all get together and talk about ideas and plans, watch films, invite movies, meet with producers, et cetera, et cetera. So really September is the kickoff for our programming year. We sort of grow ideas and meet with, amongst ourselves over the summer and try and figure out, you know, strategic things that we can do in the meantime. But that's really when it gets going. And then we visit a bunch of festivals between September and Sundance. We go to Sundance every year as well. We see things there and get to inviting them and talking to our contacts and friends and seeing what we can make happen.
Yeah. And when you watch films and meet with talents and consider their inclusion in the Sarasota Film Festival, what kinds of films are you looking for? Anything, any criteria?
Well, it's really, you know, it's a not that complicated of a process, but basically, you know, we have 10 days. I know how many screens I'm going to have in advance, so we know how many movies we can show.
Right.
And then we start breaking it up into categories. We have in competition, out of competition, short films, feature-length films, documentaries, narratives. And each one of those, we're not going to take more than a certain number. So we know how many, basically, titles that we want, we think that our community will support in terms of the sheer volume of what we're doing. And then from there, we really try to find things that don't overlap too much. In the cases like sidebars, this year we're doing, for example, a green cinema program about environmental issues. So we'll try and find films that fit into that category. Or in the case, you know, you guys were mentioning earlier about Hal Ashby,
mm-hmm.
We're trying to find, you know, get our hands on as many of those as we can. Those take up slots. And, you know, the number sort of whittles down from there. We always have way more films interested in playing here than we can accommodate, and films that we're really interested in, we have to say no to, unfortunately, just because it's a fixed number of days and a fixed number of screens, and we just can't make everything happen. But we try. We try.
Oh,
so
you guys do a phenomenal job, and there's so much choice here with 160 films. I mean, there's something for everyone. Speaking of other kinds of film festivals, probably the world's most renowned film festival being the Cannes Film Festival. You guys were visited by the executive director of Cannes recently?
The executive director of the market, actually, okay. the place where they buy and sell all the titles, came into town and met with our board president. They had dinner together, and he was really just asking him for ideas about, you know, how Sarasota can grow and trying to show him the town a little bit and get him invested in the festival here. And I think that went very well. So he was in the States and took time to meet with our board, which was very nice of him to do. And, you know, we're not trying to be a big market festival like, you know, the Sundances and the Torontos of the world. We really are for the community and for the people who come down here to watch movies. We're never going to be the place where hundreds of industry folks descend and buy and sell movies. We're really going to be a place where we're showcasing things and having, you know, a good time and in the sun and everyone enjoying themselves. That's really more of the focus. So,
and that's really what I love about your festival, and I've said this before, in that it really promotes a conversation between audience and filmmaker. It really is for the film lover. The whole festival is focused around people that love movies, and that's wonderful. I'm wondering though if festivals in general and yours in particular have seen any effects from the recession that's going on.
Absolutely. I mean, Jackson Hole in Wyoming is sort of the poster child, but they closed their festival this year because of the economy.
They closed?
Tribeca. Yeah, Jackson Hole, Wyoming's
gone
now. Yeah, their film festival is gone.
Oh, my.
Tribeca just announced the other week that they're cutting their program essentially in half, and they've lost two of their title sponsors this year. Sponsorship has been a problem for everybody. The money out there for corporations that used to give don't have the money to give anymore. Our festival runs on a lot of regional and local businesses, small businesses that have been hurt more than you might imagine. So that has been tough. We've really done a lot of good faith work with people in town here to still get them involved in any way that we possibly can. If it's not cash or sponsorship, we're putting their logos on things and trying to get them to come out and have a good time and see films and tell their customers about us and things like that and showing our customers about them. So we're trying to find creative ways that may not be, you know, so much cash-based anymore but are more in line of what a nonprofit should be doing, which is celebrating film, getting the appropriate people involved locally, and that's been successful. But we have, you know, we have seen a significant drop in corporate giving. We've scaled some things back in terms of cost. Luckily for me, and for my department, we've been protected by our board and by our executive board president. Our theaters have been untouched. Our projection has been untouched. We're still able to travel people in and put them up. We've got free rein to program the films that we want to program and do what we want to do creatively. So that's been really a blessing for us to have that sort of license to continue on in the face of what's otherwise been very, very difficult.
Yeah, it's a tough time. Tell me about, we've talked about this before, but tell me a little bit about the personality of the festival and how it makes sense that it is in Sarasota. How does that area define this festival?
Right. I mean, Sarasota itself is a city that sees itself and, you know, sort of projects itself as an arts-based community. There's several theaters here, theater companies. They have their own ballet company. They have a renowned opera company and opera house. We've got a couple of museums that are very prominent, galleries all over town. There's a symphony orchestra here. I mean, it's a very arts-driven town. And so our goal is to fit film into the overall conversation about the arts in Sarasota, bring the state of the art, not just, you know, the classics and the older things, which we try and bring in as well, but also, you know, state of the art, cutting edge, new things, young filmmakers, emerging artists, because cinema is a living art form. Unlike a lot of, you know, performing arts these days, operas, you know, many of them were written by people hundreds of years ago, or art where you've got, you know, the museums here in town carry a lot of masterpieces, older works, but not a lot of contemporary stuff. We're really a very much a contemporary organization. So we're trying to fit in and grow Sarasota artistically as well, get them involved. A lot of people, you know, throughout the country, and I'm sure you guys have experienced this as well, when you want to talk seriously about movies, they think of the multiplex and the shopping mall and teenagers running wild and playing video games and selling chicken nuggets at the concession stand.
Yeah.
And no one takes it seriously. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's seen in a lot of ways as a disposable thing in the culture. Opening weekend hits, it's a big movie, and then it goes away in a month, and you never think about it until the DVD comes out.
Right.
We're trying to create a dialogue that's more along the lines of theater, of opera, the real art. In Europe, it's the opposite is true. I think a lot of the institutions in Europe treat it as an art form, and that's why those festivals, like you mentioned, Cannes and Venice and Berlin, and they thrive because they take the art of film seriously. So our goal is to have a good time and you know, have people in, but to do it in a serious way that really appreciates living contemporary artists. And Sarasota has been a really good platform for that because they've, as an arts town, take us seriously, and they take film seriously, and they have a good time at the same time. It's a nice combination. So that's really how this place has really sort of blossomed.
It really is. It really is like that. The film festival really does feel like that, very respectful of the art form, and it showcases it as an art form, which is nice. Tell me the list of films that you look through every year. Artists, their works reflect the culture that we live in. Have you noticed a shift in themes and tones from some of these films?
I mean, some of the things that we did. Let me put it this way. I went to Toronto this year. I'm a new, recent father. I have a 7-month-old son.
Congratulations!
And,
congratulations! Yeah.
Thank you. I only said that to get your accolades. I went to Toronto this year, and every other film seemed to feature a child in crisis, a dead child, a dead sibling, some sort of family disruption around children. And that has been a prominent theme, I think, for the last year. Now, we've picked and chosen, I guess, some of the titles that we think are the best, but that has really emerged. Familial crises has really emerged in the past year. I think, you know, the economic downturn is only going to play into that more, but people are going to start seeing a lot more family in crisis related work. But that really thematically has been one of the overwhelming, when we're wading through all of the films and trying to decide what we want to show, films about that issue, we could have put together a whole festival just on that issue. I mean, we couldn't do that, but we could have. And it was sort of staggering and a little bit depressing to see so much downbeat stuff. That said, there are other things, trends that have emerged this year that we're really surprised about that just happened organically, and are exciting to us. One is that we've got a lot of films by women directors this year. Women have been behind the camera making some amazing films, and we've got several at the festival this year. So that was sort of a pleasant surprise. And it had nothing to do with us trying to find films by women or, you know, sort of ghettoizing women filmmakers in any way. It's really about the films that we liked. A large portion of them happened to be made by women. So that was an exciting trend, and I think that you're going to see a lot more of that as well, hopefully.
Well, that'll be great. Tell me how the Hal Ashby retrospective that you're doing, and there's a tribute event to Ashby that caps that off, and of course the premiere of, like we mentioned before, the never before seen cut of Looking to Get Out.
Right.
Where do the seeds of that begin? Is there a roundtable where you creatively? Yeah. Go ahead.
That's okay. Your guest on Wednesday, Nick Dawson, is a friend of mine, and.
Okay.
And he and I were talking about his book, and I'm a large Ashby supporter and advocate and fan, and I know that his influence is truly underappreciated by the public on today's contemporary cinema. You look at a Wes Anderson, David O. Russell, an Alexander Payne, people like that. They are, I mean, driven. You watch the movies and you can't help but think, oh, my God, Hal Ashby could have done this. You know, I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. So we were very lucky to meet up with Nick. And at the time, he was finishing up his book, which is coming out at the festival. But I jumped on that with him immediately and said, we'd really like to help you launch this book. And do something special around it. Would you be willing to partner with us and work with us to try and make that happen? And Nick happily agreed. And so we've been really working in concert since this past autumn to put this together. Mm-hmm. And one of the he'll tell you more about it on Wednesday, but one of the things that we discovered when in talking to Nick is that he had met with Ashby's daughter, and the two of them had sort of uncovered this lost cut of Looking to Get Out, which is, the, as you mentioned, the film from 82 with John Voight, Burt Young, and Margaret, that Warner Brothers had the rights to, but he never got the director's cut into theaters. And
right.
It was sitting in the UCLA Film Archive, the print. So Warner's is going to be putting that film out on DVD in a few months. And we went right to them and said, listen, if you've got the print and you're ready to put it out on DVD, we're wondering if we could, you know, show it first in a theatrical setting and try and get everybody involved to come down.
Mm-hmm.
They were very into the idea. John Voight in particular, who you also said you're speaking to, is a very, very big champion of this movie, and he helped us out tremendously in securing the rights to show it. So we've been working on this whole thing for quite a while. It's taken months and months, but it's been worth it because it's come together, and we're very happy about it.
And we did a pre-recorded with Mr. Voight, and we're playing that on Wednesday before Mr. Dawson comes on, and I told him, as a film fan, this project, Looking to Get Out, it feels like a real gift, an Ashby film that you haven't really seen before. This is the world premiere at your film festival, and that's very exciting. Mm-hmm. And a beautiful story, kind of how it's come full circle, poetic in a way, the journey that this film has taken with Mr. Ashby's daughter's involvement, and it's very moving. All of them will be there representing this film, correct?
Yeah, we're doing our filmmaker tribute this year at the Sarasota Opera House, and we're creating a 30-minute film about Hal Ashby and his life, and sort of a tribute video that we're showing at the tribute evening. And then afterwards, we're having everybody come on stage in sort of a conversation style, you know, 45-minute conversation, just recounting their experiences with Hal Ashby. And there's, you know, Norman Jewison, who we've had here as a guest before, but who gave Ashby his job, his first job as an editor, and was instrumental in getting him the directing job for The Landlord. Ashby actually won an Oscar for editing In the Heat of the Night for Jewison. So Norman, he's going to be here talking about his experiences. Ileana Douglas, whose grandfather Melvin Douglas won the Oscar for Being There, is going to be here to represent her grandfather and talk about her affinity for that film and her deep love of that movie. She's got the new DVD of Being There. We're also showing a high-def remastered print of Being There at the festival.
Oh, cool.
And, built off of the same project as the Blu-ray disc. But she, on the Blu-ray, does a complete commentary for the film, Ileana Douglas, talking about
she
her
does.
Love for
I've heard that.
Yeah, which is terrific. And then so she's here. John Voight will be here talking about Looking to Get Out and Coming Home, which we're also showing. He was in both of those films that Ashby worked on. We've got David Carradine from Bound for Glory here to talk about it as well. So it's going to be quite a special evening. We're very, very honored that all these people have said yes and that they really want to come and remember Hal Ashby and talk about his life in front of our audience and help us celebrate. And then at the end of all that, we're giving the award to Mr. Ashby's daughter, Lee McManus, who will be on hand to accept on her father's behalf, which is really great. I'm really excited.
Yeah.
This is really sort of, every year we get to do these sort of once-in-a-lifetime things. We've had Werner Herzog in the past, Liv Ullmann last year. I'm like, it can't get any better. And each year we seem to find something where I get equally as excited. It's like unbelievable that this is happening. We found a print. We're going to world premiere a 27-year-old Hal Ashby movie. It's like, what are the chances? We're very lucky.
It's great. I love that about the festival. And of course, the festival regulars, like Steve Buscemi, I believe Joey Pants will be – Joey Pants. Joe Pantoliano.
Joey Pants is fine by him, I'm sure.
Yeah. I called him Joey Pants on the show, and it just felt right.
That's right.
They'll be returning, and you have a conversational event in conversation with Bill Paxton this year.
Right. Bill, actually, the funny thing there, Bill is a huge Ashby fan as well, so he's asked to introduce the montage at the tribute. So Bill Paxton will be at the montage at the tribute as well with the montage. But we're doing a luncheon in his honor. He's getting our Career Achievement Award this year, Bill Paxton. Then we're going to be having an in conversation with Bill Paxton the night before the tribute, so the Friday, April 3rd here at the festival. And then, we also have – I don't know if you guys have talked about this already, but Christo and Jean-Claude are coming.
Yes.
The artist Christo, we're showing every film ever made about them. From all the Albert and David Maisel's films, the Michael Blackwood movies, the Hissen films from Germany. We've got a 13-film retrospective of Christo and Jean-Claude happening. So they're going to come to town as well. I mean, it's kind of an overwhelming number of good people this year. We're very, very excited about that, too.
It very much is. And actually, Paxton is one of my favorites. And Richard Schiff is going to be there. And he's another one of my favorite actors. I love Richard Schiff. I adore him every time I see him in something. What is he there for this year?
Richard's coming to the festival. He wants to see the Sarasota. He wants to see the Sarasota Film Festival. I don't have a film with him, and we're really just working with him to show him the festival, to have him here. He'll be at the tribute. We're also having a fundraiser after the tribute happens, the Ashby tribute, and he's going to attend the fundraiser on our behalf and help us raise some money for the festival this year. So we're very excited that he's coming.
I love him. Now talk about some of the highlights here in terms of the films you'll be showing outside of the Ashby retrospective and so forth. Are there any titles you're particularly excited about showing off to the public?
I mean, as a programmer, they're all my babies. I love them all. or else I'll get phone calls saying, why didn't you say my movie? the one thing I do want to say is we have a new program in place this year that I think is sort of noteworthy. For our competition films, in the narrative feature and the documentary feature category, in the past we've given cash prizes to filmmakers in the hopes that they would take that money and go out and make more work. This year we're really trying to honor the films themselves, and we've partnered with a couple of companies, Film Movement for the Narrative Feature Award and First Run Features for the Best Documentary Feature Award, and the winning film gets a distribution deal, which means they're going to get DVD, video on demand, theatrical release for winning the award here at Sarasota, which is a significant, I think, step forward for our competition program. And these companies have done, major films in the past. So they've got the new Shane Meadows film at Film Movement, and First Run Feature have always done the 49 Up, 21 Up, 28 Up for documentary awards. So these are significant deals for these filmmakers. We're very excited about the competitions. There's a very diverse, we've got international titles. So it's a range of things from America. We've got Korea, the UK, Iran, things from Chile, movies from Canada, Norway, France. So it's a nice mix, and the Philippines. It's just a very strong lineup in the competition. So I'm really excited. I hope those movies take off, that people really embrace the competition this year, that they go check them out, and that, you know, when we give the awards, those will also be given at the tribute, the
yes.
Ashby tribute. So people will really be invested in finding out who wins and knowing the filmmakers, these up-and-coming people. So that's very exciting for us. And then the opening night film I'm particularly excited about, which is The Messenger.
Yeah.
Oren Moverman's film with Woody Harrelson and Ben Foster. They'll both be here for the opening night, as well as Oren Moverman, the director and writer. But it's just won an award in Berlin for screenwriting, The Silver Bear. It's a really, really powerful movie about a soldier who comes home from Iraq and is reassigned to the casualty notification unit, going door-to-door to the families of fallen soldiers and informing them of their loss of their loved one. And it's an incredibly powerful movie. And in a way that a lot of Iraq films have been, you know, political to the point of resembling high school plays, this movie is the complete opposite of that. It's a very human, apolitical story that embraces the reality of these soldiers and their lives when they come home. And I think it's going to be just a knockout. And we've actually partnered with MacDill Air Force Base down here by Tampa. Mm-hmm. We're bringing in 400 soldiers for opening night for free, and we're putting them in the theaters, and they're coming to the party afterwards.
Oh, cool!
And we're really, it's really an exciting program this year for opening night. So I'm sure they'll all have their picture taken with Woody Harrelson. so which will be great, you know. So we really want people to check that out as well.
Yeah, that sounds like it's going to be a very emotional evening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it's a great lineup tonight. It's a great lineup during your festival, and like you said, world cinema is well represented in this festival. Something like 25 different countries, 6 continents.
That's right.
It's amazing. Amazing lineup. Tom, you do a great job.
Yes, you do.
And I can't wait to shake your hand again this year when I attend.
It'll be great to see you down here, and we encourage, you know, everyone who listens to the show, fans of the show, come on down. Let us know you're coming. Drop us a note, and we'll say hi when you get here. We'd love to have everybody join us.
Absolutely. The website is www.sarasotafilmfestival.com. You can get all the details there, the film schedule in detail day by day there. Plan your itinerary just like I have. You guys will have a great time. And, Tom, thank you so much, my friend. I'm looking forward to it.
We're looking forward to having you down here, and thank you again for the opportunity to talk about it. Really appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, sir.
No problem.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, that's Tom Hall, Director of Programming for the Sarasota Film Festival, an Ashby retrospective. I mean, I can't get over that.
That's a big thing. That's enormous.
A world premiere of an Ashby film
that
we haven't seen before.
I know.
It's a movie geek's dream right there.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, next up, let's welcome our next guest to the show. We're excited to speak to this gentleman. Our next guest has assembled an outstanding body of work in film and television, including terrific series like The Mentalist, CSI, Star Trek Enterprise, and Battlestar Galactica, and big screen efforts like Collateral Damage, The Trigger Effect, and Holes. Now he stars opposite Clive Owen and Julia Roberts in Tony Gilroy's highly anticipated Duplicity. That sounds like a good gig, doesn't it?
That sounds like an incredible gig. I can't wait to see that film. I'm so excited.
Yeah. Please welcome to the show actor Rick Worthy. Rick, are you
here? Hey, guys.
I am with you.
And welcome. Hello, hello, hello.
How are you doing, man? Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, man, I'm doing good, bro. I'm sitting outside freezing my butt off. But I was inside in a bar, and it was too loud, so I'm sitting outside on the sidewalk and in the East Village.
Oh, really? In the East Village? Oh, that's
okay.
Yeah.
Give me a sense of, before we get into Duplicity, tell me a little bit about you and your journey into becoming an actor. Did you always know this was something you wanted to pursue?
You know, I think I knew, man. I think I knew when I was probably 5 years old. I was always pretending to be other people. And, you know, if you ever met my mom and dad, they could tell you that, you know, I was the kid who was always dressing up and, you know, trying on like their clothing and my brother's clothing and you know, walking around the house in my mom's high heel shoes and, you know, wearing my dad's belt and stuff, and I always wanted to pretend and play, make, you know, pretend and play other people. And I think when I got into high school, it really, really was evident that I wanted to be an actor because I started doing a lot of theater in high school. And then when I went to college, I just let it fly and dove in.
Yeah. And actually, I understand that when you graduated from college, you went to Chicago, the kind of the Chicago theater scene, right?
I did, yeah. When I left University of Michigan, my brother and his wife had moved to Chicago, and I had very much considered going straight away to New York and starting, my career there. And I didn't go to New York for a little while, and I kind of checked it out, and I called my brother up, and he said, hey, why don't you, come check out Chicago? And so I did. I got on the Amtrak train and went to Chicago and ended up staying there for a few years. And it was really the best place for me to be. I had no idea it was such a great place for an actor to be. There's a tremendous amount of theater in Chicago. And of course, all the Stephen Wolfgang is there. And Gary Sinise and Malkovich and all those guys started there. And I thought it was an excellent choice.
Yeah. It really is, and it's a very artistic community there that values their theater, and that's nice to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Were there actors that you followed that you kind of admired?
Yeah, I had always thought William Peterson was awesome, and when I saw To Live and Die in L.A., which is to this day one of my favorite movies, I was just so impressed by his work, and. I got a chance to see him on stage a few times, and I just said I really want a career like his. He was just so outstanding, and from representing Chicago very well, and he was a guy who, we both came from the same place,
right?
And we coincidentally had both worked for the same theater company, Victory Gardens Theater, on the north side of Chicago, not too far from DePaul, and that ended up becoming kind of my home. For a while, I ended up doing a lot of shows there, and that's where I met Billy Peterson. This is before CSI. A few years later, this show called CSI comes on, and he's a star of it, and we're all happy for him. And now it's in his 10th year, I think. So one of many actors that I kind of admire a lot. Of course, Malkovich and Sinise and. There's a lot of other actors too who don't have a high TV film profile, but I know their work is on stage, and they're just as awesome, I think.
Yeah. Now, did you spend any time with Peterson on the CSI set as well? Because you've done work on that series, correct?
Yeah. You know what? I just did CSI. I kind of had a recurring role as one of the emergency room doctors, Dr. Stewart. It's not a very big role, but they always bring me in when it's like the shit hits the fan, and Dr. Stewart to come in and solve, make everybody healthy and happy. And when Brass was shot last, there's a cliffhanger season, I think maybe 2 years back, and Brass gets shot, and I'm the doctor who saves him. This year, Larry Fishburne is Peterson is off the show, I think, temporarily. I think he still produces it. But Lawrence Fishburne is now the head of the show, the lead in the show. And I got a chance to work with him a few weeks back. And just a great guy. Just a great guy to clown around with, in between shots. And then when it's time to go, he's there. He's 100% there,
That's good to hear that he's a good guy to clown around with, because that is the most kind of authoritative voice you've ever heard.
Yeah, I mean, he really brings it. I mean, he he's so grounded, man, and he's you never know how people are going to be until you work with him, and of course, having seen all the Matrix films and every other movie he's done, I was like, oh, he's going to be just the force of nature, to be reckoned with, and he turns out just to be just the coolest, sweetest. Funniest guy, he's just hilarious.
Wow. Now, speaking of television, and I hope I'm not bringing up something embarrassing here, I think your first appearance on television, if I'm not incorrect here, was Dance Fever.
Uh-oh, he's going to hang up on us.
You're right. You know what, man? Exactly, you guys are right. That was my very first appearance on TV.
Wow.
I was a young... pup of 18 or 19 years old, and my older brother Kev, who lives here in New York, I'm visiting him. He and I were dance partners on Dance Fever back in 86,
wow.
Maybe? Yeah. And this is after Danny Terrio left. It was Adrian Demed was the host. Wow. We had a lot of fun, man. It was in Florida. We did our thing. We didn't win, but we had a great weekend.
You know, I didn't even have a question about it. I just thought it was cool that you were on Dance Fever. So.
Back in the day, yes.
let's get far ahead here. Your new film, Duplicity,
right.
Finds you in the company of some great people. Tell me about this project. How it came about for you.
You know, it came up as an audition, man. It was about a year ago. I was in Los Angeles, where I live, and my agent called and said, "Would I be interested, possibly, in going to New York to work on a movie and with Tony Gilroy?" And I said, "Yeah, of course. You know, I mean, come on."
Yeah, you'd have to be crazy to turn that down.
You have to be crazy to turn that down, and I had seen Michael Clayton probably 3 or 4 times because I thought it was so great. And I loved Michael Clayton. And the way they set it up was Tony wasn't able to get to L.A., so he requested that I go to put myself on tape up at Universal, and then they were going to send it over to him here in New York. And that's how we worked it out. And so he called about 2 days later. My agent called and said, Tony wants to give you a call. So he called me on my cell phone, and I remember sitting in like a coffee bean and tea leaf in L.A., and he called me and said, "Hey, I'm Tony Gilroy, and I saw your work. I really like you a lot, and I'd like to offer you a job." Yeah. And I said, "Man, thank you. You know, I mean, that's the only thing you can say is just, thank you."
Exactly.
Thank you, God.
Yeah. What do I have to do? Just to
what do I have to do? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So,
I'm not sure what the part is. That's just to be in your presence.
Man. Just to be in your presence, brother, is just gratitude enough. So I came out to New York last year, and we shot this movie for 2 months, and I was done in actually 2 months, and they had another month of shooting. They had to go to Italy and a couple other places, and it was an excellent experience, and now, about a year later, the movie's getting ready to be released.
Yeah. Now, tell me about, first of all, the audition process.
Yeah.
You're an actor. I'm sure you've auditioned a lot. Have you always been comfortable doing that, or have you kind of grown into a comfort zone with auditioning over the years?
You know, I think I've grown into a comfort zone. Because I initially... Like theater was like what I know first. I'm usually used to being in front of an audience of people, but a lot of times for a movie audition, it's just a handful of people in the room, and they're the important ones that need to be in the room, the director, the producer, and you gotta knock it out. You gotta try to wow them. And I wasn't initially comfortable with that because in my mind, for the first few years in L.A., I was still on stage, and I blew a lot of auditions because I was too big, I was too theatrical, as they say. And then I began, just toning it down, and I became more present in what I was doing and more direct, and now I love it. Now it's just kind of comes secondhand now because I've done it, After a thousand rejections, you get better,
I would imagine so. tell me about this script. When you first read Tony Gilroy's script, it's got to be obvious that this comes from a real writer. I mean, someone with a tremendous gift.
He's incredible.
He's incredible, man. Yeah. Did you guys saw Michael Clayton, I'm sure, right?
Oh, many
of course.
Times. Many
times. Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree with you. You guys are a real writer, and he can really phrase language and set up situations in a very unique, appealing way. When you're reading it, you kind of want to keep turning the page, and you're like, this is interesting as hell. You're caught. I remember reading just the first few paragraphs of the page one of the script of Duplicity, and I said, "Oh shit, he can write." He's really good. Yeah.
It's also what he did with the Bourne movies. He has said, on the
record,
the Bourne, the books
that
they're based on, he said, are were not meant to be made into movies because he said they just don't work. But what he did, stripped them down to the bare essentials.
Yes.
And let's be honest, he made them work.
Yeah. He made them work, man. I love the Bourne Identity films, and what he did with the novels is just, it's I really don't think you can get any better than that. You know, it really made it happen. It made it visual, made it cinematic, it's very, very, very excellent work. And we were joking around on the set one day. He said he might do another one, but he's not sure. And it depends on what his wife wants him to do. So, you know, but
depends what his wife wants him to do. Is that what he said?
Yeah. He said, if my wife wants me to do another one, I might. You know, I don't know.
Well, Bourne fans, start writing letters to Tony Gilroy's wife because
to Mrs. Gilroy.
Is there a benefit for you as an actor to have your director also be the writer of the piece?
That's an excellent question. I really like when that happens because I feel like I'm getting it right from the guy who wrote it or the gal who wrote it, and it's their piece. They know in their head how they want it to play out and what they want, you know. And a couple of years back, I wrote and directed a short film with my best friend, and this is a short, you know, 20-minute film we shot on HD for like $5,000. But the experience of that was really cool in that, we wrote it, and then we co-directed it, and we basically kind of cast our friends and ourselves in it. And I was able to really see kind of from a different point of view what it's like to direct another actor. And the best directors that I've worked with, they understand how to talk to actors. You know, like they're comfortable. They know how to speak the language. You know, they know how to say that right thing, that one right thing. They can kind of put you in the right direction. You know,
yeah.
And Tony's like that. He just knows how to talk to you. You know, and he makes it creates an arena for you to do your best. You know, you really want to like excel. Some directors are like, okay, I need you to like cry on right over here, and I need you to, when you're done there, okay, be mad over here, and you know what I mean, like, they kind of get point you in this very kind of weird, nebulous direction. You're like, well, I need something specific, I need something, you know, that's concrete to kind of work with, you know.
Yeah, it is a special language, and I know that some directors are known for moving their actors around like furniture. That's not conducive to a creative experience.
Some of them treat us like furniture, you know. Stand over there and do this and that, you know. It becomes like, you kind of become almost like a robot in a way, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me about your character in this one. Dale Rames, I believe, is the name of your character.
Dale, you know, man, I had so much fun with this guy. He's a corporate spy. He's a surveillance expert. He's a corporate espionage expert. He's ex-military, ex-Navy SEAL. He's super tough. He's badass in a way, you know, and he's kind of the muscle, if you will, you know, of all these other spies. And I wanted to make him so different and unique because when you're working with Clive, you know, Clive is you know, he's tall, he's handsome, he's this kind of, you know, this leading man guy, and I wanted to kind of go opposite and create a whole character for Dale. So I grew this kind of big bushy mustache, and I shaved my head down, and you know, I kind of look like I look a lot like my dad.
Really?
But I wanted to make him kind of different in how he looks and the way he walks, and I think I achieved it just from watching some of the footage. But, the movie is really interesting, you know. It's about, you know, of course, Julia Roberts and Clive Owen are the leads, and Duplicity essentially is about two corporate spies. They each work for different companies, and they're both kind of, you think they're initially kind of spying on each other to try to find out what the other company is making. These guys, they work for cosmetics company, and there's some kind of new formula on the street that's supposed to be the cure for baldness, and they decide to kind of come together and work together instead of working against each other and try to go after this formula. So the corporate espionage business is just what I've discovered through the research is that it's a multi-billion-dollar huge business, like millions and billions, like billions of dollars are lost each year, different companies. Because they lose their product because some other company perhaps stole their idea, or you know, some kind of way they have spies within their own company that are flying for another company. You know,
yeah.
Very, very like deep and complex. And I thought that was kind of the cool arena, you know, to have spies. You know, so you know, normally like you would see kind of the war and identity stuff, which is, you know, all government stuff. Here it's all like, you know, the world of, you know, of corporate America.
Yeah, I am really taken by the premise of the movie, and it also strikes me as, maybe I'm incorrect on this from the trailers that I've seen, but it, almost a throwback to a fast-paced romantic caper, kind of tit-for-tat dialogue. It feels like that. Is that correct?
It does feel like that.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. And I actually haven't seen Duplicity yet. The premiere of it is tomorrow night here in New York, and that will be my first time seeing it in its entirety. I've only seen maybe 5 minutes of it, but from the trailers that I've seen and the trailer that's now online, yes, it does have that cool, funny, sexy, romantic feel to it, and with the music mixed in, it just works, you know. And I think that was just the perfect way to approach this, you know, material.
Yeah, yeah. Now, are the nerves going for you with a big premiere tomorrow night? Are you nervous about seeing yourself? Are you good with that? Seeing yourself on screen?
I mean, I'm cool with it. I'm not nervous. I think I was just a little bit nervous because up until maybe 6 hours ago, I didn't have anybody to go with me. So. So, thank God she finally said yes. You know, so.
That's pretty bad, man. When you're in a Julie Roberts and Clive Owen movie and you can't score a date, that's terrible.
Yeah, it's pretty tough. Yeah, that's the story of my life.
You should have pulled out the Dance Fever card. I mean, that would have saved.
I could have maybe won some points with that.
That
always works. It always works. Never leave home without it. So.
So Rick, do you have anything in the fire right now? Anything upcoming for you?
Well, I don't know if you guys knew, but I was working on Battlestar Galactica for the last 2-3
years. One of the greatest shows on.
Oh, my God,
without
man.
Without a doubt, the greatest show on television, without a doubt.
Yeah, brother, thank you for saying that.
I don't know
agree.
What we're going to do after next week on Friday night. So.
I'm just going to, you know, it's so sad. I mean, like, we're all, you know, and I'm not part of the regular Battlestar cast, but I'm one of the Cylons, and, you know, they brought us up to Vancouver to shoot and to work on the show, and
right.
we all felt like we were part of the show, and you know, it's just a special, one of those great shows that comes around every now and then. It's smart, it's intelligent, it's political, it's drama, it's, you know, and it's just sensational, you know, and
more,
you know, every week it's like a whole different level, you know, and What we did was we shot a 2-hour MOW that's coming out I think next month,
right? Okay.
Or possibly May. Yeah, and it's called the Plan, or I think the first title was called the Cylon Plan, but it's about the whole 4 seasons told from the point of view of the Cylons.
Oh, that's
and,
very interesting. That's a good.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it was just a very cool idea for them to, you know, to go with and to create a 2-hour movie about the whole show, but told from our point of view, you know,
right.
The Cylons, you know, the Cavils, the Dorals, the Simons, and the Annas, and Capricas. Yeah.
As we've seen with this season, that's a very important point of view, because what I love about the show is just when you think you have everything figured out, you got,
right.
In a matter of 2 minutes into the next episode, manage to screw with that entirely.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's amazing.
Oh, it's totally amazing, yeah. I mean, even now, like, I'll sit down and, like, I'll watch, you know, just watching something, it blows me away. I'm like, God, that's, the way they set it up was just, it was genius, you know, I remember driving down Sunset Boulevard. I remember looking up at the billboard before Battlestar premiered. I saw the Battlestar Galactica, and I saw Edward James Olmos in space, and I said, oh, this is going to be good, you know what I mean?
It is.
Oh man, and they really, really delivered on it, you know. So, you know, I'm happy for those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Rick, we can't wait for Duplicity. We're both very much looking forward
yes,
to it.
Yes, we are.
We're thrilled for you, man, and we wish
Thank
you the
you.
Best of luck, and we
yeah,
and we welcome you back to the show anytime. Anytime you
Oh
come.
Man, God bless you guys. You guys have been really awesome, and I think you have an awesome show. And I'm honored that you asked me to be on it. So.
Anytime, buddy.
Anytime.
And thanks for calling us on location. We can hear the city sounds.
You hear the sounds of New York.
Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
Nothing like it. Nothing like it.
Exactly. That's right.
Thank you, Rick, so much.
Okay, thank you. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right,
Rick Worthy, his new film's Duplicity with Clive Owen and Julia Roberts. Good stuff.
Yeah, great stuff. Now, I'm looking forward to that. You know, it's like really funny. You know, we have that next Friday, and the series finale of Battlestar. So it's a quite a doubleheader there.
That's a good weekend for him. It's a good weekend.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the movies that came out this weekend, and then we'll get to our final interview of the evening. Excuse me, I got the hiccups.
That's all right.
Now, two big profile releases this weekend that we've both covered extensively on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Race to Witch Mountain and Last House on the Left. You have seen both?
I've seen both of them. You know that. You don't even need to ask. You know I've seen both.
And I've been able to check out one of them.
Okay.
So let's get your opinion on Race to Witch Mountain.
I'll tell you, it's what we were talking about with Andy, and it's just The Rock has charisma, and it's all over the place. But he makes this film worth watching. I wouldn't even give this film a second thought, but he's in it, and he's just has that screen presence that's there, and I'm willing to sit down and watch it. I think he's actually better at the family-oriented entertainment than Arnold was. When Arnold was in his heyday as an action hero and he did the family-oriented films, I think The Rock does it a lot better. It's a fun movie. I wouldn't say it's like the greatest film I've ever seen, but it's definitely a fun film. It plays into the whole UFO and conspiracy theories and mythology very well. But it's The Rock. You're watching it for The Rock, I think. So
yeah,
and he's great.
Yeah, he is wonderful. and just to let everyone know that. You can find interviews with the director of that film, Andy Fickman, and the acclaimed composer of that film, Trevor Rabin, on our archives.
I think it's worthwhile going to see. I think it's a lot of fun. You could do a lot worse. So.
And also, Last House on the Left was the other major release this weekend. The remake of Craven's 1972, I think it's 71, 72, horror film. Some consider it a classic, and it is a classic of sorts.
I was reading an article about the New York Times today.
I read the same article, and we've spoken to the two main kind of killers in that piece, Garrett Delahunt and Ricky Lindholm.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about this. This is one that I saw earlier today. Now, just to be clear. We both think that the original is terribly effective.
Yeah, but it's not as good as the source material, The Virgin Spring.
It always struck me as, at its heart, and this is why the material, and I think this isn't an entirely bad thing, it always struck me as an exploitation film with arty pretensions.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like what Romero's done over and over again. You know,
he's done it over and over again.
At first, it felt pretty sincere, and that it had its place. But after a while, it
hits you over the head repeatedly. Yeah.
Yeah. So this one, just on the basis of its structure, throws up mixed feelings for me.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone that's seen the original, obviously, there's a conversation to be had about comparing the two.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mind the enhancements that they made or the changes that they made from the original film, kind of fleshing out the plot,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. And I think that the movie really benefited from having real actors in there. But at the same time, you watch the original, and it feels so real and so
mm-hmm.
immediate. I mean, you can't necessarily argue with the acting in there.
No, you can't.
But this one is, obviously, it's a little more polished.
Oh, it's very polished compared to the other one, yeah.
Yeah, because I don't think you can get by with making a movie like that today.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I'd love to see that. I think the closest they come is something like it's like they're shooting something with a camcorder. That's almost what it felt like in the first one.
Well,
they were shooting that in the woods with a camcorder or something.
The closest they've come to that as far as a theatrical release to that kind of brutality would be the original Henry Portrait of the Serial Killer.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. This one is, it is what it is. It's very brutal, and it does have a very cathartic ending for a lot of people. A lot of people were cheering in the theater. But it still maintains that very disturbing, visceral quality.
Yeah.
And I think that Tony Goldwyn and Monica Potter as the grieving parents that seek vengeance, I think it works because they're so committed to it and they're such great talents.
Yeah, I don't mind. I noticed a lot of our friends over at Horror Yearbook hated the remake. I actually, it's the catharsis, as you say, that you're waiting for. I just think that's built in. You're waiting for the parents to, you know, take their revenge, and rightfully so. But, you know, after you're done watching it, you're just like, okay, it's not something you want to, like you said about the original one, I think you said it best, it's not something you ever want to watch again. And I feel the same way here. It's, okay, I'm done. There's really not much to be had here.
Yeah. I was shocked by the audience I saw it with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because I live in Florida, I'm sure, but there were about a dozen women over 70 in there.
Now, what do you mean shocked by? Let me ask you this, because like, I go see these films, usually it's like mid-Friday afternoon or late Friday afternoon or early evening. There's not much of an audience. Now, did you have a lot of people in your audience?
Not many. I saw it this afternoon.
Okay.
It's just that I think that these are people that probably pay to see every new movie. That's what they do on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't. They didn't express their whether or not they're offended by walking out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were committed to the movie. They set through it. It's just surprising that the demographic that I have.
Right. The only movie I've seen recently where people walked out, ironically, was Funny Games. The remake of Funny Games, where most of the audience left.
Yeah, and that's uncomfortable. That's definitely an uncomfortable movie, and it almost because it feels that it has no morality.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Last House, I think you that's the whole third act.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, but with Funny Games. And I didn't. The material, implicit in the material,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of a cold lack of morality.
Right.
And I didn't like Funny Games, probably for the same reason, one of the same reasons why you didn't mm-hmm. quite care for it. It's because it played very preachy to me.
Mm-hmm.
And
hypocritical,
the preachy,
almost.
Yeah, it was hypocritical. And I know he tried to do that, and maybe that can be distinguished as some form of morality that
mm-hmm.
he's trying to teach us. But it was almost like he's saying to us, you know, this is what you want. You want to see all these horrifying
mm-hmm.
things.
You're
oh,
right.
I'm not going to show it to you because it's not good for you.
Yeah,
very strange movie. Last House, it's almost beyond a horror film in a way.
Mm-hmm.
The last act, of course, works on a horror film basis.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
But it's just so horrifying and so disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the kind of horror film you go to see to get your rocks off. And
I think you're right. I would agree with that.
And if you do, I have no interest in knowing you.
Yeah, really? I'd be really scared.
Yeah. So, and we're reviewing the rape scene. And
No. I don't want to go into that. You know, because when that was going on in the movie, I kept thinking of what you were talking about. We talked a couple months about the original one. And I was like, you know, and you're supposed to, I mean, you're supposed to feel uncomfortable. If you're not uncomfortable during that scene, then I am really disturbed. But it is a very disturbing sequence. And it's like, even though I hadn't seen the original for a good 20 years at least, it's still, you know, it brought back memories of the original. It's like, I don't want to watch that again.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something you're like, oh, this is the rates. No, I am not into that. Sorry.
I tried to watch the original again. I just couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those odd contrasts here. It's a bad film, but in a way, it is entirely effective and it does what it needs to do.
Mm-hmm.
So is it really a bad film? I mean, it isn't in a way if it accomplishes what it sets out to do.
I think when it comes, if I was going to give Wes Craven, like, I think his most effective, I mean, I think his best film is the original Hills Have Eyes. If I was going to pick one, I would, that's the one I'd go with, because I think that's a terribly frightening film.
Yeah.
And it still works to this day on me. He didn't need to, they didn't need to remake that. The original works just so well, still to this day.
Yeah. It is incredible, though, looking at the numbers from this weekend, which they're hard to avoid, and we don't really speak about financials on this show very much, but Race to Witch Mountain, the family pleasing film, obviously came in first, followed by Watchmen, that
which
suffered
dropped big time.
Major drop. And this is an incredible investment that the studio has made in Watchmen.
And there's a lawsuit that was going on during this too, before this came out.
Yeah. Then they settled, splitting up grosses and that kind of thing. But this has to be a disappointment for them.
Mm-hmm. I would think so. I think there's a lesson to be learned here, and not a lesson. I don't, that's the wrong word. But you can't. You know, it's like we said last week when I told you if Coppola had adapted The Godfather the way it was written, you know, if he had, or the way that Puzo had written the original script, we wouldn't be talking about it today. And I think there's a lesson to be learned here. You don't have to be this hardcore devoted to the source material. You can, as a director, especially someone like Zack Snyder, you can bring in your own vision a little bit here.
Yeah, I mean, because let's be honest, fan culture is wonderful, and obviously this material has some diehard fans.
Oh,
but you have to make a movie for everyone.
Yeah.
Because that culture won't sustain you.
Well, that I think happened, and I know the Star Wars prequel is not a great example to use, even though the first film and the third film especially did very well financially, but it's the second film where Lucas thought he had to appease the fans. You know, he added a lot of, like, fan things in there.
Right.
And that's what really hurt that film. I'm not saying the first one was anything to write home about, but he felt he needed to, because the fans complained so much about so many things in The Phantom Menace, he felt, okay, I'm going to go ahead and I'll give the fans, like, Boba Fett and Boba Fett's father, I'll give him an asteroid chase and all these things. And, you know, when you really start to do that, you're alienating the rest of your audience, the general audience, and you can't do it. You can't make a film that way.
Yeah, I mean, those prequels only really worked when you felt the arc, you felt that...
And that's not until the third film.
Yeah, you felt that poetic story unfurling.
And even as
destiny,
much,
yeah.
And I'll defend the third film, but even I know, you know what, Jamie? As much as I love Star Wars and grew up with it, I wish to God he never made the prequels.
Yeah.
I really wish to God he didn't do it.
I wish he let somebody else write them and direct them.
Oh, that anything would. Oh God, anything would have been an improvement. I wish they would have done something with Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull.
Yeah, I wish they would have given that to the Daniel Petrie Jr.
Exactly.
Yeah, but even so, fan bases. Yeah, they're good for opening weekend, as Miss Movie Fan said.
Mm-hmm. But after that, you're on your own. I mean,
not enough to sustain you. And fan culture, people are still gauging this. Obviously, there's the Comic-Con. That's a huge event, and it's important to get the buzz out there on the internet and everywhere else on your film. But it's been proven both ways. Dark Knight wasn't merely a fandom movie. It appealed to everyone.
Everyone.
Snakes on a Plane was relying on that internet buzz and that culture, and it tanked. It can't rely on that alone.
No, and I wonder if Snakes on a Plane, because some of those early indicators that I guess New Line thought, hey, we have a hit on our hands. I don't know if those guys, the suits, got it, that a lot of those websites were kind of jokes, really. They were making fun of the film. No one was really saying, oh, God, I can't wait to see this. We're going to camp out for it. A lot of those jokes, a lot of those websites were really sort of really humorous takes on the film.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a big lesson to be learned with that film, too.
And I think we're entering a culture... I think this is valuable, and we're going to see this more and more, and actually we're seeing it with the next guest we speak to.
Mm-hmm.
The different modes of distribution. I think that some movies can play better at home, and they should be tailored for that medium. And I hate to say that as a movie aficionado that loves the theatrical experience, but when so much financial stuff is at stake... it shouldn't be a mark of shame if you're a direct-to-DVD anymore. I think that stigma is going to be going away soon.
I hope so, because I think it's a good thing to. Sometimes that's the DVD, the director DVD, or the on demand is a great avenue to reach more people.
Yeah, I think so too. Okay, so Duplicity is next weekend.
Yeah, that's this Friday.
Okay, so we'll be back. And just to let everyone know, this Wednesday, as we said, Mr. John Voight and Nick Dawson will be joining us to speak about Hal Ashby and his never-before-seen cut of his 1982 film, Looking to Get Out, that premieres at the Sarasota Film Festival this year. And then we'll have Miss Bobby Osteen, who's a very renowned editor, and her husband, Sam Osteen, was one of the great editors that edited The Graduate and so many classic films,
mm-hmm.
Chinatown. And she'll be with us to speak about her new book, The Invisible Cut, and then the remainder of that show will be dedicated to a South by Southwest recap. Their festival commenced Friday.
Oh.
We have quite a few guests associated with films from there, including something special that's happening in the IFC now. IFC is spotlighting a few of those films.
They are, yeah.
They're premiering them on demand right now as we speak, so it's almost like an interactive film festival going on on that video on demand channel. And the filmmakers from a movie called Best Worst Movie. Have you read about this?
I've heard about it, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, it sounds like these could be many of these movies I've seen lately, but yeah.
Yeah, this group of people got together and made a movie called Troll 2, which incidentally has nothing to do with the first Troll.
That's good.
It was a dentist, I believe, that financed most of it and starred in the lead of the film, and it's an awful movie that has grown in cult status, and much to their surprise. People have conventions and stuff around this movie, and they're applauded, and everyone wants their autograph. And it's about this big journey that this film has taken. It's a documentary on that phenomenon.
Right. Cool.
There's also a movie that I'm checking out at the Sarasota Film Festival called Winnebago Man that also played at South by Southwest. You remember those viral videos of the guy filming the infomercials on the Winnebago, and he just keeps flubbing his lines and cursing, and it's very temperamental. It's about them searching, trying to find that man, searching for that man, and the man is in hiding. And it really speaks to the impact that these viral videos have.
Cool.
Now, there's a lot of great films. There's another film I'm excited about seeing at Sarasota is Tyson, James Toback's new documentary.
That I really want to see, and I saw that documentary on him last year, and
mm-hmm.
he is a fascinating individual. A great, great, great filmmaker.
Yeah, and wouldn't it be something if we got Mike Tyson on Movie Geeks United?
Mike Tyson or James Toback, either way, you know, I'd be very excited.
Yeah, who would have thought that would ever happen? Mike Tyson on our movie show.
That would be our greatest show. And we would be he could say whatever he wanted.
Yeah, that will be the most careful interview I've ever conducted. I don't want to say anything.
Nothing that could upset him.
That could upset the beast. Mighty Kong has awoken from his slumber. That's what I say every time I take a girl to bed.
Oh God.
No, that's not true. Okay, on that note, let's get to our final interview segment of the evening. This is a great film. It's a new film starring John Malkovich in a very colorful animated role, the way I love to see him. He just delights in this role. Colin Hanks is in this film as well, and it's the first time he's acting across from his father, Tom Hanks. And Steve Zahn, Emily Blunt, this is a topless cast. The film is called The Great Buck Howard. It's currently available on demand services and opens up in New York and L.A., I believe, this upcoming weekend. So enjoy this interview that we have with the film's writer-director, Mr. Sean McGinley.
You do know who I am.
Buck, there's a Tonight Show 61 times.
You have to say with Johnny Carson, not the nitwit who's on there now.
I quit law school determined to do something different with my life, but that still didn't prepare me for my new job with Buck Howard.
Which way you can toss my salad when you get back to the hotel? I don't know what you're doing here.
The auditoriums we played in were old, usually half full, but Buck didn't seem to notice.
Welcome to Cincinnati!
I love this town.
Welcome to Wausau, Wisconsin.
I love this town. I love this town.
I'm Buck Howard.
The minute he came out on stage, he was in his element. Everything he did, he made the impossible seem possible.
And your number is 17.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that wild? It's wild, isn't it?
I mean, my college roommate was managing a multi-million-dollar hedge fund, and here I was helping Buck Howard with his benefits, starring Gary Coleman and the guy from the Police Academy movies. Strange thing, though, it was kind of cool.
This spring,
you've got to quit this job.
You can do better.
It is over for Buck, and everyone knows it but him.
What are you going to do now, kid?
I might fail miserably, but I have to at least try.
Good luck.
Comes the story of two men.
I have a boyfriend. Oh, forget I said it.
Looking to make a comeback.
We need to get you some attention right now.
If they need to see something, I've got something I can show them.
It is enormous.
The legendary mentalist Buck Howard, best known for his many appearances on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, put some 800 people to sleep.
Suddenly, Buck was hip.
Presented the great Buck Howard.
Magnolia Pictures presents...
There was a long period of time where I wasn't hearing much about you, Buck. Suddenly you're back. You're everywhere. You're living in the fast lane.
I have to say, Cullen, I've always been hip.
It's Conan. It's Conan.
John Malkovich, Colin Hanks, Emily Blunt, with Steve Zahn and Tom Hanks.
I would like to dedicate this next song to Sulu from Star Trek. May the Force be in you.
The great Buck Howard.
I love this town!
Tell me, first of all, where this idea came from. What were the seeds of this idea before you put pen to paper?
In 1994, going way back, I had just quit law school and moved to Los Angeles, and I had a, just randomly, much like the character in the movie, I got a job working for a guy called the Amazing Kreskin. And it was, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he was... So it was just one of, it's, I mean, like the first 15 minutes of the film are basically right from real life, and after that it goes into the exaggerated or the fictional. But for years it was a story I would tell. I worked for him for about 4 months, and it was just a story I'd tell at parties and stuff like that. And I had a friend who urged me to write something about it because he felt like there was a story there. And so I guess it wasn't until many years later that I actually wrote it. And I think I wrote the first draft in like 2003. And,
yeah,
that's where it all started.
Was it really? You kind of had to reflect on that experience to realize what it meant for you before you could write this.
I guess it just didn't occur to me at first that it was anything more than an interesting story that I tell at parties, and it was really just through thinking about it more. And I think, you know, in between the time I'd worked for Kreskin and in between the time I'd written this thing, 8 or 9 years had gone by, and I had seen more of the world of show business and how, you know, it kind of hit me like what was so compelling about Kreskin, why I'd been telling these stories. And it was just that just you kind of saw that there are these people, you know, and there are lots of them in Los Angeles who had have had some measure of fame at one point, or even like a tiny little measure of fame, and the impact it's had on their lives. And you also see a lot of people in Los Angeles who wish that they were more famous or more well known or more recognized for their talents than they necessarily are, and that's something that that I've always found interesting.
Yeah, what fascinates me about this film, it's a terrific film, but is the caliber of cast that you've assembled. Just incredible, remarkable actors, and I'm wondering what that process was like when you wrote these characters. Did you have particular faces in mind?
I didn't. I had the character of Buck Howard, who, and the character became something very different, or not very different, but considerably different from Kreskin, and he was a lot of fun to write just because he was someone who could really say anything and kind of be a big jerk and, you know, act crazy, and so, but I didn't have anybody in mind. I just was kind of having fun with it, and then Colin Hanks was the first person we got the script to, and he agreed to play the character of Troy, and from there we got Playtone, which is Tom Hanks' production company, to agree to produce the film, I never dreamed at that point. You know, Playtone's a great production company, but I never dreamed that Tom would say he wanted to play such a small role, you know, just because he wanted to do a couple scenes with his son. And then once we found the financing, we were able to go ahead and and make an offer to John Malkovich. And I think once you have, you know, John Malkovich and Tom Hanks attached to your movie, then you're going to get a lot of other good actors.
Yeah, I think that's a safe bet.
Yeah.
Wow. Tell me about directing these different fantastic actors, but I'm sure that they all have different approaches and techniques when it applies to the work. How, as a director, do you kind of juggle between one person's needs and another?
I wouldn't say that, you know, I think most good actors are pretty similar in that they show up with the character ready to work and they're professional. And I'm not Mike Nichols, and, you know, I don't know Mike Nichols, but I've always read that he really, you know, knows how to get a performance out of an actor and really works with them. And that's not me. I'm not like that. and I know I'm not like that. So I just try to stay out of their way and maybe here and there, you know, nudge them one way or another, or just encourage them to try something that maybe they wouldn't have thought to try. And also I just try to let them all know that the character is theirs, and that I trust them, and that I want them to feel free to come up with anything that, you know, I just want them to feel free to express themselves and feel like it's theirs. So,
yeah.
And I think I got a lot of good stuff in this film from lots of actors just because I encouraged them to express themselves. So for instance, you know, John came up with so many great things that I never would have thought of or that weren't in the script. And you know, I think it made the film so much better just because, so I think if I did anything really well, it's that I made, you know, someone like John feel like he could, like I wanted his contributions.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, and it was just, it was a gold mine of funny stuff that he came up with and brought to the table.
There really is. And this is one of those Malkovich performances that it looks like he's having such a good time. It's a performance that he just chews on with wild abandon. It's a great thing to see.
It was so much fun, man. I can't tell you. Just every day on the set, you could tell like the whole crew was having such a good time just because John was playing this character and was really going wild with it, and it would just be so much laughing and, you know,
yeah,
and just talking about it. It was really a great mood.
Tell me about your approach in terms of starting the production. You obviously know you have an A-list top-of-the-line cast here that responded to the great material that you provided them. But tell me about that first day or that first week. Is there a process where you have to find your footing within this production before you feel comfortable?
The only other film I've done was a very small film called 2 Days, and the budget on that was $300,000, and it was, the crew would have about 10 people at any given time. I remember the first day we filmed this, I show up and the parking lot's packed with trucks and trailers, and I remember walking in and just feeling like, Jesus, you know, how am I going to do this? And this, I might be in over my head here, but I'd say it wasn't more than an hour into the actual filming that it occurred to me, you know, it's actually pretty similar to what I did on the tiny little $300,000 film. You know, there's a camera and there are actors and you're filming them and you're trying to help them do their best and you're trying to make your day. And so it wasn't more than an hour before I felt, you know, completely comfortable. And I think I was lucky that I had, you know, someone like Colin who had been a part of the project for so long. And so I felt like I had a friend there by my side who was behind me, and John, you know, was somebody who just was such an ally. You know, he made it very clear from the beginning that I could say anything to him and he wasn't going to, you know, get mad at me or become impatient with me.
Yeah.
And he made it clear that he just wanted to do a really good job and have a good time. And so it was, I think everyone kind of looked to John since he was there every day and was such a big star. And I think once he was, you know, once he kind of motioned that he was cool with things and having a good time, then everyone sort of relaxed, and it made me, you know, and kind of like made me feel more comfortable.
Yeah. I understand there had to have been a comfort zone already established with Colin, because I understand you guys had worked on this for two or so years together before you got it set up.
Yeah, Colin came on before there was any money or anything and just said, I like this film, I'd like to be in it, I'd like to play this character, and I'll do anything I can to help that happen. And so... You know, he. You know, there was a time like where we had financing from a different person who was going to finance this years before, and so he was with me through all that. You know, because that financing fell through, and then we were back to square one. And so he was somebody that I would call and, you know, either celebrate or commiserate with, you know, depending on what was going on. And it was, you know, because people, it made it a lot easier too, because, he was involved and Playtone was involved. And so people always say to me, like, what was it like, you know, with Colin Hanks and Tom Hanks? And by the time we filmed, I had gotten to know both of them a little bit, you know, Colin very well and Tom a little bit. So it wasn't that big of a deal. I spent a little bit of time with them.
Yeah, I would imagine that it was a special situation for them to be acting across from each other, though.
Yeah, I think it was, and I think they had fun with it. But again, you know, I think it was a little bit weird for a minute, and then once we got there, it was two actors, you know, trying to get the scene done and trying to work it out.
Yeah,
and trying to do their best.
Very well. I was merely trying to add a little perspectivo, as the Latins say.
I think you've done that.
Good evening, Troy. You can bring that and toss my salad when you get back to the hotel. That's a hell of a guy.
Dad, I'm sorry. Haven't heard from you in over a month. Had to call your friends like I was some kind of freaking cop. I know. I would have killed to go to law school, Troy. I would have killed. I hated it. I wasn't happy.
You think I danced out the front door every morning in my adult life happy about where I was going to be spending my day? I don't know what you're doing here. And I don't think you do either. But come on. You're smarter than this. You are. You are smarter than this. I hope he enjoys his Cobb salad.
Tell me, when you watch the film now, how does it compare to how you initially envisioned it before you started shooting it?
You know, in some ways, you know, it's better than my wildest dreams. You know, in other ways, you know, I think, you know, it's hard for me to watch it without thinking of, you know, I wish I had gotten this shot that we didn't have time for, or, you know, I wish I had thought of this, you know, thing that I am thinking of now and but I didn't think of at the time. So I think there's the typical stuff that, you know, nothing's ever really perfect. But there are some, you know, sublime moments, you know, where, you know, especially with John, where he just, it's not really so much stuff that I did, it's just stuff that happened or that he came up with it just makes me so proud that the situation existed in a way that John was able to come up with this line, or that Colin was able to come up with, like, a certain expression. And, you know, and I just feel, you know, enormously proud to have been part of the project.
Yeah. Have you seen it with a, how should I put it, a non-industry, non-jaded audience yet?
Yeah, I've seen it with all different kinds of audiences. You know, we had early on, we had a test screening, and those were just a bunch of people they plucked out of a mall. And so I watched it with all different kinds of audiences, you know, and it's weird, you know, it's different, you know, certain lines get enormous laughs and other lines, you know, that I thought were going to get a laugh don't get a laugh. It's always such a strange experience.
Mm. And the release schedule for this one, this has become more and more popular. It's not only opening in theaters, but it's also available on video on demand services. Mm-hmm. So it's getting out there through a variety of venues. And for a film, do you think it works particularly well for this film, or do you think that's a viable opportunity for this film?
You know, I don't know. You know, I think it's still kind of an experiment doing it this way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my position is I want as many people to see the film as possible and hopefully enjoy it. And I'm not really much of a businessman or an expert on film distribution or anything mm-hmm. like that. So I don't care how people see it, as long as they see it, it's fine with me.
Yeah. And tell me, do you have any ideas for projects coming up?
Oh man, there's a million things. I'm always
That's good.
That's good.
Nice to hear.
This film took me like 4 years to get made, and the little one I did before that, 2 days, took me 4 years to get made. And so, I optioned a book recently and wrote the script based on that. The name of the book is Karoo, K-A-R-O-O, and it's written by Steve Tesich, and so that's something that I'm trying to get made right now.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's great. And do you think that this, how do you think that this journey of putting this film together, has made you a better director for your next one?
Oh, geez. Oh. Is that me or you? I don't know.
I'm not sure.
I just feel like I have so much more confidence now. You know, I can.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like after working with John and Tom and Colin and Emily, like, I could go work with any actor and feel comfortable in the situation. And, you know, and the guy who shot this, the cinematographer on this, was Tak Fujimoto.
Yes.
Great.
Wow.
Such a great cinematographer, and he kind of demythologized a lot of that for me. And so I'd feel comfortable doing just about anything.
Mm-hmm.
About anything now, and just, you know, and being, you know, the director of a crew of like 60, 70 people on certain days, I just feel like so much more confident now.
Yeah, well, he is an amazing talent.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to let you go, but let me just ask about him. What's the communication between the two of you during shooting? What is that like?
He's a pretty quiet guy, and he doesn't have much to say, and he's not. He communicates differently than most people that I've come across in my life, and I think it's probably because he thinks visually and I think
mm-hmm.
more orally.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting because I had a lot to say to him about how I wanted the film to look, and he's not the kind of person who will say to you, "Okay, I understand what you've said here, and I will now go do it." He just would kind of look at you and nod, and you know, I was wondering, like, is he getting what I'm saying? Are we, you know, speaking the same language here? And it really wasn't until we began filming, you know, and right away you could see it. You know, you'd go and he'd show me the lighting setup, and I'm like, oh, this is exactly what I was describing to you. So clearly, you know, you got it. And in some ways, it, you know, you come up with other stuff that is even better than I had envisioned it in my head. So it's kind of like this weird, almost osmosis kind of process. And I'm sure that's what makes him so great.
Oh, he's fantastic.
It's weird. He's a very just subtly a genius.
Yeah. And were there films that you referenced in terms of look and feel for this one?
I didn't. I think he was kind of a little frustrated by that, because what I was saying to him was that I couldn't really think of any films, and I'm a big film buff, that looked this way. I said to him, I'm like, I want it to look like the theaters that I went to when I was working for Kreskin. I want it to look like these old, and I kept telling him, like, I want the faded glamour. I want things to have, like, a look of faded glamour. And so I kept trying to think of some film that had this, and, you know, Sunset Boulevard, but that's black and white, and, you know, The Dresser was another one that I referenced.
A great one.
And for Tone, My Favorite Year, but none of these, like, looked like what I wanted, you know, the film to look like. And so it really just came time to, like, we had to go look, find these locations, and then I would show them. I'm like, this is, you know, see this theater that we found in the Crenshaw district of LA? I'm like, this is what I want the film to look like.
Mm, yeah.
And once we saw the locations, then I think that helped him a lot. And the way he set the lights and the frames were just amazing.
Really, really great. Sean, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For your time, and thank you for the film.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
Okay, take care. Thanks
take
so
care.
Much.
Okay, have a good one.
That's Sean McGinley. The film is The Great Buck Howard. It's available now on demand and in theaters in the New York and L.A. area. All right. Hanging in there, Jerry?
Yes, I am. Yes.
I'm going to end the show tonight. We did a surprise interview with John Voight Thursday night in connection to this Hal Ashby film. And it was a very surprise interview where I submitted the request. He called my cell phone, and I had 14 minutes to schedule a show and record an interview with him. It was wonderful. And he's a great guy. I just want to end the show tonight. And then right after this clip, we'll play the closing music, and we'll be out of here. Just a little outtake from that interview, kind of after the interview clip. And you can look forward to the premiere of that interview Wednesday night, as well as an in-depth conversation about Ashby with his biographer, Mr. Nick Dawson. That's Wednesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. And Jerry, my friend, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Had
a good
time.
As always.
Had a great time, and we'll close off with this clip from Mr. Voight. Thanks so much, everybody.
Did you do it?
That's it. That's it.
Okay, that was pretty harmless. I think it'll do its job.
I really can't wait. I really can't wait for this. And it was, it's a great honor. I was breathless when you first called because I don't get called by John Voight every day. So I apologize for that, but I appreciate your time.
Oh, no, it's great. It's great, yeah. And, you know, you're helpful. You know, Jamie, you're a good guy. So
well,
you're, you know, your enthusiasm for film is very evident. And you're, you know, we have too many people in this business that aren't really in love with film, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they'll look for something dopey to sell or whatever, you know, something looking for controversy or something seamy or something, you know, nonsense.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, this has just got to be fun for us all, you know, and a community of people who love film and love the idea that one of the films, that this, the story of this film will be very telling, because it is, after all, it's a film that was made by one of our greatest directors.
It really, he definitely was. And, you know, I respond to passion and passionate filmmakers and artists, and it's so ironic because we're paying tribute to some of the great films of the 70s. We have a series ongoing, and we were going to tackle Mr. Ashby. We've done McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and, mm-hmm. and we're about to do some other titles. But so this is a perfect opportunity to open that door to our audience of Ashby film.
This would be good. And Hal's work is, of course, very unique. I mean, he did Harold and Maude. He did, you know, and The Landlord was his first one, which was a nice little film, very nice film. And then, of course, Harold and Maude, Shampoo, Last Detail, Bound for Glory,
all
Coming
of those.
Home, Being There. I mean, these are sensational films, and Looking to Get Out is going to now take its place among them.
I hope so. I hope so. Yeah. I'm sure it will.
Sure. Yep.
Fantastic artist, and so are you. And I thank you so much for your time.
Great, Jamie. Me too.
And
I'm happy to do it.
I'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Okay, lad. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.